Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Brian's Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner. We're in module number 7 still on the apostolic mission. This will be lesson number 31. We are getting towards the end of this section on the Apostle Paul and his ministry as we are progressing through the book of Acts. This will be the 18th part of the section dealing with the Apostle Paul. We probably have about 2 more sessions, I'm guessing, to finish up the book of Acts. And then we'll be moving into our next module, module number 8. But we'll talk about that a little bit more at a later time. All right, let's get our Bibles out. I want you to go to Matthew chapter 22. You may remember last time I briefly mentioned the fact that that the Apostle Paul, when he was giving his speech on the steps of the temple, to his brother Jews, that he spoke to them in the Aramaic language and all those things. And I pointed out the fact that his message was essentially validating or confirming Psalm 110 verse 1. And I want to spend just a few minutes reviewing that because I think it's one of the critical things that's overlooked with regard to Paul's ministry, with regard to the way the New Testament is handled, the way it's interpreted and understood. You guys probably have been with me for a while. You know that I have harped a lot on Psalm 2, which is the Messianic Psalm about, where God says to his son, "You are my son, today I've begotten you. Ask of me, I'll give you the nations, your inheritance, and the end of the earth for your possession," and so forth, which describes the fact that the inheritance of the earth and of all the nations, the very same inheritance essentially that was promised to Abraham, that Christ is the seed of Abraham that promise was ultimately made to, and that is the Son of God. And then, of course, the second probably most important psalm, Messianic Psalm, is Psalm 110, verse 1, where the Father says, or David, when he's writing the Psalm, he says, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." And then it goes on to talk about how he's going to rule in the midst of his enemies. And so that particular Psalm is very odd and strange because in the Jewish way of thinking, human beings, people don't go to heaven. But the Jewish, the Messiah, the one that Dave was speaking about, was specifically said that the Father says to him, "Sit at my right hand," that is right beside me on my throne, "until I make your enemies your footstool." And so there's this interim period of time that is predicted in that psalm where the Messiah of Israel, the Son of God, the one who is to inherit all the nations and rule them with a rod of iron, that one is to sit at the right hand of the Father, not ruling. See, that's the important point, not ruling, because he says, "Until, sit here at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." That is, I'm going to cause you to rule over your enemies. But for a while, you're just going to have to sit here at my right hand. Now, this psalm, Psalm 110, is probably, I think I can say emphatically, is cited in the New Testament more than any other psalm, and probably more than any other Old Testament passage of Scripture. The fact that the apostles constantly refer to this fact of Christ being seated at the right hand of the Father over and over and over again during this interim time is really very critical. And it's not just that, the apostles, after Jesus ascended to heaven, that the apostles discovered this psalm and started using it to explain why Jesus, we say he's alive and he was resurrected, but where is he? He's not here. It wasn't that they, discovered that psalm and began to use that in that way after his ascension, but Jesus himself also was using that psalm in that way. I want you to turn in your Bible to Matthew chapter 22 and look at verse 41. It says, "While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, saying, 'What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?' They said to him, the son of David. And that's, of course, because of the covenant God made with David. He said to them, how then does David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying, quote, the Lord, that is Jehovah, said to my Lord or my master, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. If David then calls him Lord or master, how is he his son? Now that's the end of Jesus' statement. But then Matthew adds this, and no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day did anyone dare question him any more. Jesus actually, by referencing Psalm 110, verse 1, Jesus put a stop to the scribes and the Pharisees quizzing him all the time. They were not able, they didn't have the answer to this theological question. But Jesus did, and the apostles did, which is why as we progress in the New Testament, if you remember, this Psalm 110, figures very prominently in Stephen's martyrdom, the very first martyr in Acts chapter 7. Go there for just a moment. When Stephen was being stoned to death after his speech that he gave, verse 55, but he being filled with the Holy Spirit, that is Stephen, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God, and said, look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. Now again, this is a direct reference to Psalm 110, that the Messiah was not going to remain on earth. He was going to be assumed up into heaven to the right hand of God for a period of time prior to him coming to establish his kingdom on the earth. And so verse 57, then they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, and ran at him with one accord. And they cast him out of the city and stoned him. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man called Saul. Now, why did they stop up their ears and cast him out of the city? Look, it says they cried out with a loud voice and they stopped up their ears and then they threw him out of the city and they stoned him to death. And Paul, whose name was Saul at the time, was consenting to his death, it says in the very next verse. Now, why did they say that? At what point did they throw him out of the city, stop up their ears, and try to kill him? Or they did kill him. At what point? You know, if you read his entire sermon, if you will, he said a lot of things against the leadership of Israel. You know, he called them stiff-necked, and you always resist the Holy Spirit, and all that kind of stuff. He said a lot of things that were pretty harsh. But it was only when he said, look, I see the Son of Man. Now, notice the phrase, Son of Man. The words Son of Man, as they're used of Christ or the Messiah, always have a reference to his being a physical human being. We see this in Daniel when chapter 7, I believe it is, where it talks about the Son of Man was brought before the Ancient of Days. Daniel says he saw the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, and he was brought before the Ancient of Days, and there was given to him a kingdom and authority that all nations would serve him. And so we see this phrase, the Son of Man. We see Jesus using it constantly in reference to his second coming and so forth. But Stephen uses it here, that he sees the Son of Man, that is a human being, in heaven at the Father's right hand. Now, that was something that was just completely vexing to these Jews. And so, if we continue, we see that it was at this point in Paul's message, if you skip over to chapter 22 now, where we left off before last week. Skip over to chapter 22, we'll see that beginning in verse 17, that the rage against Paul also had to do with his identifying this Lord that's seated at the right hand of the Father with Jesus Christ, the Son of Man. You see that in chapter 22, beginning in verse 17. Let's go there. Now it happened, well, first of all, he gives his testimony. We talked about this last week. He gives his testimony about how on the road to Damascus, he saw the bright light and he heard a voice from heaven saying, you know, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he acknowledged, and the voice acknowledged that it was Jesus, right? He says, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting, and so forth. So, but if we continue down, it says, a little later, he says, verse 17, now it happened when I was returning to Jerusalem, was praying in the temple, I was in a trance, and he saw him. Again, Paul, what he's saying, I saw him, is he's talking about Jesus Christ in heaven, just like Stephen did. I saw him. Where was I? I saw him saying to me, make haste, get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. So I said, Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. And when the blood, now notice this, he references Stephen, and he references the event of Stephen who saw Jesus at the right hand of the Father also. And now here's Paul at the temple, and he's seeing Jesus at the right hand of the Father, speaking to him directly and telling him what to do. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. Then he said to me, this is Jesus at the right hand of the Father, depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. And they listened to him until this word, and then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live. Then they cried out the more and tore off their clothes and threw dust in the air and all this kind of stuff, right? So, you know, it's really, I find it very, very fascinating that this idea that Jesus was alive, number one, after he was crucified, that he had ascended into heaven, that he was presently fulfilling Psalm 110. But it's not just that they were assuming that he was fulfilling Psalm 110, verse 1. It's that Stephen and now Paul were actually not only seeing him there, Stephen saw him there, but Paul not only is seeing him there, but he's speaking to him and he's telling Paul what he wants him to do, that he's going to send him off to proclaim his message to the Gentiles, because the Jews were not worthy to receive it because they were rejecting it. They had crucified Christ. So this is of course what got them all stirred up. Now, what we want to do is, I want to go down to verse 23, which is, verse 24. This is where we left off last week. So let's pick it up now in verse 24. The commander ordered him to be brought to the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that they might know why they shouted so against him. That is why the Jews were so angry. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? When the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, take care what you do, for this man is a Roman. Then the commander came and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? And he said, yes. The commander answered, with a large sum I obtained this citizenship. And Paul said, but I was born a citizen. Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because he had bound him. The next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all the council to appear and brought Paul down to set him before them. Now, this is interesting because Paul was a Roman citizen because, not because of his lineage, because he was a Jew, but he was a Jew who was born in a Roman colony city, which was the city of Tarsus, which is up in the area of Turkey today. Now, because he was born within the city of Tarsus as a Roman colony, he automatically received Roman citizenship. Now, you can see it's very clear that there was a distinction between how a Roman citizen was to be treated under Roman law. He had certain rights, as opposed to the other peoples that the Romans had conquered that were living in their own lands under an umbrella of Roman authority. But the Romans were much harsher with those people than they were with the ones who had official Roman citizenship. And so because Paul was a Roman citizen, he was able to exercise his rights under the law. You can see clearly that they were going to scourge him, which was basically whipping to get the truth out of him. And basically, it was a form of torture. Torture was sanctioned by the Roman authorities for certain people, but it was not sanctioned for Roman citizens. And so as soon as they found out that Paul was a Roman citizen, it says that the commander was afraid or the centurion was afraid because he knew that there were consequences if he was to torture a man who was a Roman citizen against the rights that were granted him by Rome. All right, so let's now begin to look at chapter 23. Now this is really interesting because in chapter 23 we see a second speech. It's rather brief, but a second speech that the Apostle Paul begins to give. In fact, as you may remember back in chapter 22, he gave a speech which led to his arrest, right? When they were going to try to kill him after the end of his speech. Chapter 23, he gives another speech. As we see, as we progress through the rest of Acts, we'll see that in chapter 24, he gives another speech in his defense. He gives another speech in chapter 26. And I believe that's, through chapter 26. And then there's a final one when he's in prison in Rome. But what we have here between chapter 22 all the way to the end of the book of Acts, chapter 26, what we have sandwiched in these chapters is Paul's arrest, his awaiting trial, his several different hearings that he was given after he was arrested, his imprisonment in Jerusalem, and as we'll see in a little bit, they move him to Caesarea, his imprisonment and his hearings in Caesarea, then his journey by ship to Rome to stand trial before Caesar, his imprisonment in Rome for 2 years prior to his trial by Caesar in Rome, and then that's where the book of Acts ends. But what's fascinating about these last several chapters in the book of Acts is they give us a lot of insight into Paul's theology, into Paul's thinking with regard to where his personal ministry to the Gentiles fits in with God's overall plan that he has laid out throughout the Old and the New Testaments, and how that's related. And the reason that this is so important is because there are various theologies today that try to drive a wedge between the New Testament and the Old Testament. And what I mean by that is, for example, some of you have heard of dispensationalism. Dispensationalism basically says that God has had two different groups of people that are his chosen people or his elect. And the first group was the nation of Israel, that God had a certain program, a certain set of rules or whatever that he used to deal with the nation of Israel. But in the New Testament, he has a completely separate, a completely different program, a completely different group of covenant people that are his children or his people on a totally different level, a totally different framework than the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. And so what they do is they divide the Bible up into what is passed away, as you know, all the Old Testament basically is for Israel. It's not for us, and the New Testament is for us. And they isolate these two different portions of the Bible from each other, and they isolate these two so-called different groups of God's people. In fact, when this idea of dispensationalism first came about back in the 1800s, they used to use terminology like that Israel was God's earthly people, and the church or Christians were God's heavenly people. And the reason they made that distinction is because they believed and taught that all the promises to Israel in the Old Testament had to do with the land, had to do with inheriting the earth, had to do with temporal things, while all of the promises in the New Testament are about heaven. They're about some totally different destiny for God's people that are Christians, as opposed to God's people that are Jews. And so all the promises to Israel, all that stuff only applies to them. Doesn't apply to us. And all the promises in the New Testament only apply to us. They don't apply to them. And so, you know, God's got two different, he's basically got two Bibles. He's got two plans. He's got two people groups, and he's got two Bibles, a Bible for them and a Bible for us. And what he's doing with them doesn't concern us, and what he's doing for us doesn't concern them. You know, we're going to fly away to heaven because we're better than they are. They get this crummy old earth, but we get heaven. See, that's the mentality of dispensationalism. Well, there's another theology which is its competitor, and it's called covenant theology. And covenant, don't get this confused with the covenants that we have talked about, because covenant theology does not take into account really properly the covenants in the Bible. What they essentially say, they do almost the same thing as dispensationalism. That is, they cut the Bible in half. But what they say, instead of saying that God has two covenant people that he's dealing with parallel with each other, with different destinies, they say that the Old Testament and the nation of Israel, that was a program for those people, but that God has abandoned that completely and totally replaced it with the New Testament and us. And so all the promises in the Old Testament, all the prophecies and a lot of those things in the Old Testament, they'll say, well, they were all just conditional, and because Israel rejected Christ, God just flushed all that down the toilet, and now he has come up with this new thing in the New Testament, you know, Israel is over and done with. So they're really essential. Both of these systems, dispensationalism and covenant theology, essentially do the same thing. They just go about it in a different way. They both cut the Bible in half and basically toss the Old Testament out as being not applicable to us. And then they look at the New Testament, not with the Old Testament as the foundation, but looking at it through sort of Greek philosophy as opposed to through Jewish thought. All right. And they pretty much do away with the Old Testament. They both do it. They just do it in different ways. Well, I just want you to know that both of these systems of theology, which actually, if you were to take all of Christianity, what's called Christianity, I would say that probably at least 80 to 90% of it would fall within one of those two camps. All right, if you divide those two camps up, it would make up the vast majority of Christianity, and both of them are dead wrong on their basic underlying theology about the Bible. All right, but anyway, getting back to these last few chapters in the book of Acts, the reason that they are so critically important is because they show that both of those theologies are rubbish. Both of them are nonsense. Both of them are contradicted by Paul's sermons, by Paul's defenses that he gives when he was arrested and he's standing trial in these later chapters of the book of Acts. All right, so I'll be pointing out some of those things. But the primary thing that I want to point out to you, I want you to look for it as we work our way through Paul's defenses that he gives in these last few chapters, The primary important key point is that what Paul says is the hope for Christians, the hope that he preaches to the Gentiles. It's not heaven. It's not flying away. It is the hope of Israel. The hope of Israel. And what was the hope of Israel? It was to be resurrected to the land inheritance that God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as their permanent inheritance and permanent possession. That was the hope of Israel. And the fact that Paul constantly in his defenses, when he's defending the message that he's preaching to the Gentiles, it's always the resurrection from the dead to the hope of the inheritance that God promised to Israel. And if you embrace dispensationalism, you are embracing a hope that has no basis or foundation in the Bible. If you embrace covenant theology, you're embracing the very same thing. You're embracing a hope and a destiny that has no basis in the Bible. Both of them are based in Greek philosophy, the philosophies of Plato, about leaving the physical behind and ascending as spirit, pure spirit, into heaven to be joined with the divine in heaven. This was Plato, the Greek philosopher. This was his philosophy, his theology, and he had a cosmology about the moon and the sun and all the planets to go along with it, which was absurd. And you know, it's funny that these Christians who teach these things, they accept his philosophy, but they don't accept his cosmology, which is what his philosophy was based on, because science has proven it to be absurd. But that's neither here nor there, I guess. But anyway, let's move into Paul's defense now, as he is brought to he's brought face to face with his accusers to answer the charges that are being brought against him. And that, by the way, that's one of the things that a Roman citizen, one of the rights that a Roman citizen had, was to be able to face his accusers and to give his defense in front of his accusers before the judge. All right, which is very much like our legal system here in America today. All right, but if you were not a Roman citizen, well, you didn't really get treated very fairly, because you were considered sort of a political prisoner, or a prisoner of war, or something like that, were treated totally differently without these kinds of rights. All right, so anyway, in chapter 23, the Apostle Paul is, as a Roman citizen, is being given his right to face his accusers before the judge. And for them to make their accusations in front of him where he can refute them. All right. So here's what we have going on now. So let's read verse 30 again of chapter 22. The next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, this is the Roman centurion, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear. So this judge, he's a military judge, but he is commanding his accusers to appear before him, and brought Paul down and set him before them. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, quote, "Men and brethren." Now, this is interesting, because if you remember his speech that he gave at the temple just the day before, recorded in chapter 22, he starts off by saying, brethren and fathers. And so, again, we pointed out last time how that this is a kind of terminology, is a familial terminology, which essentially saying, we are brothers, we are of the same family, we're of the same children of Abraham, all right? So we all share the same hope, the same promises, the same covenants that God made with our forefathers. We are the heirs of those things. And he's acknowledging them and himself as being on the same ground there, right? So he says, men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. Now, that's just one brief statement, but what happens? And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Wow. So Paul, he barely opens his mouth to give his defense, and he simply says, you know, I am my conscience is clean. And pow, he gets it in the face from the high priest who commanded him to be struck in the face. Oh, that's pretty sad. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. For you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law? Now, Paul had a really good point here. All right, Paul was there to stand trial. And to strike someone in the face while he's giving his testimony, and to have the judge. Now, this judge is an accuser, because the chief priest was a judge, if you will, over the religious affairs of Israel. But because the Romans were governing that whole area, the Romans were the ultimate authority, right? So it's the Romans that were to judge him. But yet the charges being brought against Paul by the Jewish leadership had to do with him transgressing the law of Moses, supposedly, right? And so to strike someone in the face before they've even been found guilty is clearly contrary to the law. So Paul had a good point here, but look what happens next. And those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? Now, this is an interesting point, because the law did command the utmost respect to be given to the high priest. And so even though what Paul said was true, he was out of line, in a sense, for using that kind of sarcasm. He called him a whitewashed wall for using that kind of sarcasm, or it says reviling here. Against the high priest. Then Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. So he quotes the very passage from Exodus chapter 22, verse 28, where God commanded in the law that you're not allowed to speak evil of the ruler, the high priest, in this case, of his people, right? But what I want to do is I want to point out something here that seems to be a bit of a contradiction, all right? I want you to go back, keep your finger here, but go back to Acts chapter 7 again, where we were talking about Stephen. Who was it that Stephen was giving his defense before, just before he was stoned to death? Go back to chapter 7, verse 1. This is after Stephen was arrested at the end of chapter 6. In fact, let's go back and read the charges against him. Actually, go back to verse 8 of chapter 6. And Stephen, full of faith and power, did wonders and signs among the people. Then there arose some from what is called the synagogue of the freedmen, Cyrenians, Alexandrians, and those from Sicilia and Asia, disputing with Stephen. And when they were not able to resist the wisdom and spirit by which he spoke, they secretly induced men to say, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God. So, I guess that's standard fare now. You know, you just if you don't like what somebody's saying, you just start accusing them falsely. And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him, seized him, and they brought him to the council. This is the council of Jews now, not Romans. This is the same group that was accusing Paul later. They also set up false witnesses, said, this man does not cease to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law. We have heard him say that Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered to us. And all who sat in the council looked steadfastly at him and saw his face as the face of an angel. Now notice this. Then the high priest said, are these things so? And he, that is Stephen, said, brethren and fathers, using the same terminology that Paul did, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham. Then he goes on to give his long speech about Israel's history, starting with Abraham. And now Israel has constantly ignored God's commands and abused the covenants that God made with them. Right? So he does all that. But look at what happens. Excuse me. Look at what happens at the end of his speech here when he says, he's still addressing the high priest. He's addressing the whole council, but primarily the high priest asked him if these things are so, and he's still addressing that. And he says, verse 51, "You stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears. You always resist the Holy Spirit. As your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed at him with their teeth." This is when he said he looked up and he saw heaven opened and Jesus standing there in heaven. Now, question. I want you to think about this for just a minute. When Stephen was addressing the high priest and he said, he called him a hypocrite and a murderer of Christ and of the prophets, which one of these holy men did you not persecute? You know, I mean, he laid it on thick, right? Speaking to the high priest at his trial. Now, why is it that that was okay? Because, I mean, he saw Jesus standing to receive him. He was about to be killed. But here, when Paul does virtually the same thing, his accuser, the high priest, and Paul says, calls him a, he says, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall," which is certainly true. And yet, when that happened, when Paul said that, and then he was told, didn't you know, that that was the high priest, and then he sort of apologized for his harsh statement, right? And he acknowledged the fact that God says you do not revile God's high priest. That is, you treat him with the kind of respect that his office deserves. Why was it okay for Stephen, but it was not okay for Paul? What do you think? I'll give you a minute. Why do you think? Well, let me tell you what I think. All right, because it does seem like a contradiction. But if you look at what happens here, Jesus said in Matthew, in Mark 13, sorry, and other places, that his apostles would be brought before kings and rulers. They would be scourged in the synagogues, and he said that he was going to allow them to do that. As a testimony against them. And he says, don't premeditate what you're going to say. But the Holy Spirit, the holy breath of God, is going to give you the words to say in that moment when you're standing before them and you're being accused, that the holy breath of God is going to tell you what to say. Okay? Now, if you remember when Stephen was giving his defense, it says that Stephen, being filled with the holy breath, he then gave his speech, right? Stephen's speech was being given to him by the holy breath of God. And Stephen was standing in the place of Christ himself, because Christ himself was, through that holy breath, which allows Christ in heaven and the Father to communicate directly to and through his people on earth. That's what the Holy Breath does. It's this means of bringing the presence of God and our presence together as though we're in the same location, which is why Paul could say that, you know, Jesus stood by him and talked to him, yet he's in heaven, you know, or Jesus spoke to him from heaven, things like that. It's because it's this Holy Breath of God that brings this distance, whatever distance there is between us and heaven, whatever distance that is made as though it doesn't exist, because it's as though heaven and earth are joined together in that location, and Christ himself, who is at the right hand of the Father, can speak and sometimes even be seen at the right hand of the Father by his apostles on earth. All right, this is what this holy breath does. So when Stephen was filled with the holy breath and he was speaking, it was Christ himself in heaven by means of that holy breath that was giving him the words to say, to as he was fulfilling what Jesus said back in Mark 13, that he would, that his people would stand before rulers and governors and the leaders of the Jews and so forth, as and speak as a testimony against them, that is, convict them of their own guilt. But what's critical about it is that Jesus said, don't premeditate what you're going to say, but you just leave it blank. Don't even worry about it. When you get there and you're in front of them, he says, I will give you a mouth and wisdom to speak. And that is in accusation against them. So Jesus was essentially saying that he was going to, by means of the Holy Breath and this communication, that he was going to use their mouths to speak his own accusations against rulers and authorities and so forth that were coming against his apostles, that Christ himself was going to speak through them in judgment against them. All right. And so that's what Stephen did. He spoke it in judgment against them. And what was the result of that? They took him out and killed him and stoned him. Now, what happened in that incident was those rulers who listened to the words of Christ himself coming through the mouth of Stephen by means of the Holy Breath, and they heard the accusations against them. And then, when they heard the accusations, they killed the messenger, which was Stephen. They sealed their own fate. They sealed their own fate. It proves that the judgment of the words was true, and they sealed their own fate. Now, what's the difference between that and what happens here with Paul? Paul is being accused by the chief priests and by the other members of the Sanhedrin before the Romans. Paul spoke out of turn. Paul spoke from the flesh. Paul spoke not the words that the Holy Spirit were giving him on that occasion. You see, Christ did not want Paul to be executed right there. He had a mission for him. He had to go to Rome. In fact, he told him that. He needs to go to Rome, and he's going to bear witness for him in Rome as well. So speaking the words of Christ of condemnation directly through Paul's mouth to these guys who were accusing Paul, it wasn't time for that yet. It wasn't time. The Holy Breath of God did not do for Paul on this occasion what the Holy Breath of God was doing through Stephen on the other occasion. Paul spoke off the cuff. Paul allowed his flesh, he allowed his temper, he allowed his some sarcasm to come out in his words. See, you know, some people think the apostles were perfect. No, they were not perfect. They were just men like you and I. Sometimes they had a short fuse. And Paul knew that these guys were hypocrites, but he called them hypocrites to their faces. Was it appropriate to call them hypocrites to their faces? Not on this occasion. Especially in front of a Roman authority. Because the Roman authorities were watching as well, in the way that Paul was giving respect to the leaders of his own people or reviling them publicly. And Paul was out of line here. He was out of line. And when he said that, and he was reminded of what God said about respecting the leaders, even though they're wrong, he quickly changed his mind. And he quickly apologized. And I think he learned an important lesson from that as well. All right. Okay, so let's continue. He says, verse 5, then Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that it was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say, there is no resurrection, and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes and the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, we find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Well, at least there are some people on the council that were reasonable, right? Now, when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. But the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, quote, be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. We see that this was stated prior as well, that Paul was going to have to go and bear witness in Rome. All right, now we have Jesus appearing to him again a second time. Now, did Jesus come down from heaven? Did Jesus leave the right hand of the Father? Did Jesus come down into Paul's cell and say, hey, Paul, wake up. Here I am, I'm here now. No. How is it said that the Lord stood by him? Because just as the holy breath of God brings heaven and earth in contact with each other in various places, so that it's as though they're sitting in the same room with the Father and the Son versus, you know, Paul there. Christ was allowed to communicate with his apostles in this way by means of the Holy Breath. And he was able to comfort Paul and tell him that he was going to be going to Rome. Now, just one quick comment before we close, because I can see that I'm out of time here. I want you to notice that how Paul maneuvered his way out of this situation. Notice he says, verse 6, but when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee. Why didn't he say, I'm a Sadducee? Well, he wasn't, for one thing. But what was he doing? He was showing that he was, that part of the council was exactly what he was, a Pharisee, right? Pharisee was a man who tried to keep God's law right down to the minutest detail. And there's nothing wrong with that. The reason Jesus condemned some of the Pharisees, or many of them, was because they were hypocrites. They were doing it on the outside, but not on the inside. All right, but Paul's point here is that he was a Pharisee. And now notice he said, the last part of verse 6, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Now notice this, concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. Now, why is that a critical point? Well, here's why. The Sadducees were the minority group. The Sadducees were more of a secular group. Even though the chief priest was a Sadducee, and the chief priests for a long line, all the way down from shortly after the Maccabean Revolt in about 168 BC, from about that time down to this time, this group of Pharisees and Sadducees kind of split, and the Sadducees were kind of a little bit more secular. They denied the whole concept of resurrection. They denied the idea of a judgment after death. They believed that God had, you know, given his laws so that people were to obey the laws, and that if Israel obeyed God's laws, then they would receive temporal blessings. That is, you know, God would prosper them in this life. And there were many things like that in the law of Moses, right? About how God would prosper them as a nation and so forth in this life. But the idea of an afterlife, they denied it altogether. They did not believe there were angels. They did not believe there were demons. They did not believe in the resurrection of the dead, which means they did not believe in a judgment. See, they believe that all you're going to get is in this life. If you live by God's law, you know, God will advance you. And so they viewed personal advancement as being God's blessing, as being showing that they were, you know, blessed by God. Kind of like the prosperity teachers today, right? I mean, if you got the Rolex, you got the private jet, then God must be blessing you. It's the prosperity message, all right? Well, that's what the Sadducees believed. And any hope in the future after judgment, after death and a judgment and all that kind of stuff, that was, they didn't believe any of that stuff. As opposed to the Pharisees. Now, because the Sadducees had that view, you know, it was get all you can get now. They were very selfish, self-centered. They took advantage of people. In fact, the priesthood was something to be bargained for. There was a lot of intrigue going on as to who was going to be the next high priest. And this went down on for a couple of hundred years, by the way. There was a lot of, you know, people in marrying into this family so that they could gain a political advantage to become the next high priest. It was sort of like, it was bad. But on the other hand, the majority of the priests were not Sadducees. They were of a lower class financially. And they were the Pharisees. And the Pharisees believed that keeping God's law was not about gaining political advantage, about getting blessings in this life now. They didn't have the message of Joel Osteen, who is probably one of the most widely known Sadducees today, right? He wrote the book, Your Best Life Now. All right. It's that kind of Joel Osteen philosophy about now and getting advantage now in this present life that the Sadducees had. But the Pharisees, they were all about the age to come. They were all about living now according to God's law because of the promises of the life to come, of the age to come, when the Messiah was to come and establish his kingdom on the earth. And that if you live according to God's law now, even though you're not reaping advantages from it now, even though life seems, you know, very hard, it's very difficult, and, you know, you're not seeing those kinds of blessings now that God promised in the law. You're not seeing them now. You're going to see them, though, in the resurrection, because the Messiah is to come. And when the Messiah comes, he is going to overthrow all these nations, and all the righteous who have kept God's law, according to them, are going to be resurrected along with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they're going to have the inheritance that God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, so that was their hope. And that's the hope we have as well, by the way. And as we will see throughout Paul's speeches, throughout the rest of the book of Acts, he keeps emphasizing the hope that the Pharisees had as being the true hope, the correct hope. And this is critically important to us in how we handle the scriptures, how we handle the covenants in the Old Testament, and so forth. So when he says to them, look, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. And then he says, concerning the hope and the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. Paul was saying, look, the message I'm preaching is what you guys are hoping for. You Pharisees, contrary to the Sadducees, like the chief priest, right? And the minority of the council. But you guys in the majority of the council, he's saying, look, my hope is your hope. I'm preaching the very thing that you are hoping and longing for. The fact that you are trying to keep law so that you can have an inheritance in the age to come when the Messiah comes, in the resurrection. You're looking forward to resurrection and reward for all that you're doing trying to please God now. In this life, you're looking for that in the age to come. And Paul's saying, that's what I'm doing. And that's the message that I'm preaching. And this is why I'm being charged here. It's not because I'm preaching something contrary to you. I'm preaching exactly what you preach. which is contrary to what the Sadducees are teaching, and the chief priest, who was a Sadducee. So he's dividing the council. And so what happens? It says, then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes and the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, we find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel, now remember, they believed in angels and spirits. So if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Wise words. And so then the dispute happens. The Sadducees, no doubt, were coming back, and then it got all this rigmarole going between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. But the point you need to understand, and I'm going to harp on this in the next couple of lessons, but the point you need to understand absolutely is that the hope of Israel, the hope that the Pharisees had, which was derived from the covenants and the promises that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then to Israel through the law of Moses, all that hope was to be realized through the resurrection of the dead, and then the inheritance in the land, along with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, all the prophets, all the righteous men from the Old Testament, that they were all going to receive this common hope together. And the Apostle Paul is essentially saying, that's what my message is. I'm on your side, right? They had a dispute over Jesus and who he was. But regarding their overall eschatology, that is their doctrine of last things or end times, their overall eschatology was the same. And Paul makes this point clear here. And we'll see as we go through the rest of his defenses that he is constantly pointing this out, that the hope he preaches for Christians, including Gentile Christians, is the same hope that Israel has been having all through the Old Testament as they awaited for God to fulfill the promises that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, that's it for today. I know I've gone a little bit long, but that's okay. God bless you all, and I'll see you next week.